Here at Michigan Public, the NPR member station that makes this podcast and brings it to you, we host a book club. We read new books from Michigan authors or all about Michigan. And our next read is a novel by Katie Williams called My Murder.
The book came out of my genuine love of murder mysteries and thrillers, but also my kind of uncomfortable feeling sometimes about the fact that they circle around a dead woman who has no agency or voice and the violence that has been done to her.
Today, we're talking with writer Katie Williams about her latest unique thriller. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. My Murder centers on Louise, who's a resident of Lansing, experiencing a whole new kind of body horror. She's living in a body that was brutally attacked and murdered. At the same time, she's aware that she is a clone of the woman who was killed. Now, as the story progresses, Louise starts trying to figure out if her own body holds sense memories or other clues about what happened during the crime. The story raises all kinds of questions about whether our bodies are really our own, especially as technology offers us new ways of moving through our lives. Katie Williams is a former Michigander who now lives in the Boston area. Katie, welcome to Stateside and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, April. Thanks for having me.
So as I mentioned, Louise was murdered. The woman narrating the novel is Louise, but she is a clone of the Louise who was killed. This is an absolutely fascinating premise. When you were hatching this story, did it take shape in your mind of someone who almost died? Or did you begin working on the novel with a Louise who had actually died and was brought back in this way?
Yeah, so that was one of the pieces I had first, was that this was a woman who died and who'd been brought back. So I thought, what if I brought that woman back, not through flashbacks, but literally brought her back to life and put her on the page and made her the investigator of her own murder?
I mean, we're still pretty far away from this in terms of modern technology, right?
As far as we know, I think so, yeah.
And yet, you have all kinds of little touches suggesting a United States of the future, including autonomous vehicles and, you know, some VR and augmented reality technology. It was really interesting the way you sort of thought through the world. Is this something that you think about often?
You know, it's something that has come up in my creative work recently. My previous novel, Tell the Machine Goodnight, was also set in the near future. I like to imagine out just a little ways and to have technology that feels very lived in, that the characters are using in their everyday lives, as I think about how I use technology in my everyday life and the way it changes how I interact with the world, with other people, and also impacts my sense of self.
Louise is married and has an infant daughter who I guess you could say her prior self gave birth to. And her husband, Silas, we get the sense early in the book that he is absolutely achingly glad to have her back, but also achingly aware of her as a clone and kind of getting used to this idea. And her infant daughter at first is absolutely refusing to be held by her. She cries every time this Louise picks her up. What an eerie difference. I wonder, do you have kids?
Yeah, I don't. So this was a part where I needed to imagine out from my own lived experience. And I was very lucky to have friends and readers who helped me try to get that relationship, that experience of motherhood as right as I could. I hope I got close.
It's really amazing. And just the thought that maybe a clone might smell or somehow feel, you know, enough of a percent different that an infant could tell the difference. That was really spooky.
You know, I was thinking a lot about somehow the way we're, quote unquote, supposed to feel in certain relationships and how, you know, sometimes that's not always the case, or relationships can evolve and change and our sense of connection can grow over time or shift.
Louise is also part of a support group. And this is a group of, I want to say, five or six women who are all clones of murder victims. And all their cases were brought into being because of this streak of murders that were committed by the same person. And I have to say, the scenes of these women talking with each other were some of my favorites in the book. You know, how do you interact when you're expected to ally with each other, or you're expected to have shared experience through such an unusual biological situation? There's one woman in particular who Louise comes to feel drawn toward. Her name is Fern. Can you sort of explain their relationship and what seems to draw them together?
Yeah, absolutely. So Fern, like Louise, she's exploring what it means to be in this new yet old life and this new yet old body. And she's not necessarily feeling this sort of connection or continuation of her former self, the self who was murdered. Fern has decided to reject that former self and forge a completely new identity by doing everything as differently from her old self as possible. The food she eats, the clothes she wears, the way she lives her life. And I think Louise, who, you know, is also feeling uncertain as she's been resituated back into her life, finds this fascinating and maybe somewhat liberating.
I wanted to ask if you would read a scene between the two of them. Do you mind setting this up for us?
Yeah, so Louise has gone out for drinks, and Fern gets pretty drunk at the bar, and Lou takes her home. And this is the scene that follows. I waded through the mess, towing Fern along behind me. When we reached the bed, she fell straight into it, her wobbliness working in our favor. I set her feet in my lap and began yanking one of her boots. They proved difficult to remove, Fern's ankles still being drunk. "What if I bring you a glass of water?" I asked once the boots were off. She groaned in reply. "How about a bowl, in case you need to puke?" No groan this time, which I took for a yes. I found a mixing bowl on the kitchen counter, holding not the dregs of milk and cereal, but a stack of unopened mail. I set the envelopes to the side and returned with the bowl to find Fern rubbing her face against the pillow. When she finally stopped, the skin around her eyes was smeared with makeup like a bandit's mask. She stared into the bowl I handed her as if its bottom was far, far below, the deepest well. "You won't tell them in group?" she asked in a small voice. "Tell them what?" "If I puke?" "I won't tell them," I promised, and brushed her bangs to the side. She squeezed her eyes shut. "Lou?"
"Yeah?"
"They're still my parents. What I said before, they're still my parents."
"Okay.
You believe me?"
"Of course I do."
She lay back on the bed, the bowl resting on her stomach. "If you could not think of me as..." I waited for her to finish. "If you could not think of me as..." She started again, and again she gave up with a tortured breath. "I don't," I said. "I don't think of you as that," though I had no idea what she'd been trying to say. She gazed up at me and raised a hand in the air, curving her palm as if to cup my cheek, even though my face was nowhere nearby. Her eyes were half open, shining within the cages of her lashes. She was flushed and tousled and smelled deeply animal, of sweat and bedsheets and scotch. I thought about how our other bodies were somewhere else, hers and mine. Somewhere below the ground, the insects working them into soil, and from soil up through the roots of the plants and into the veins of the leaves, where finally they'd uncurl and receive the sun.
There's so much spine-tingling stuff in there, and also some really poignant things about Fern. Can I ask these questions of trauma and how people respond to it are really at the heart of the book. Can you say a little bit more about what you see as people, you know, maybe come to different understandings of what's happened to them?
Well, there is a story of trauma, a story really of sensational murder that is being told about these women in you know, news media, on social media, in the public sphere. And so I was interested in, you know, the differences between that and how the women themselves as individuals were understanding what had happened to them. And so I thought a lot about how we tell ourselves the stories of the things we've been through that have been difficult, how we tell ourselves the story of traumas we've experienced, and how we tell ourselves the story of like what it means to move on from that trauma. You know, does it become an integral part of who we are? Is that, you know, maybe productive and healing in some ways if we can say, for example, like what we've survived, like I was strong, I survived this, you know, I have this insight now. And how is that limiting to try to think of oneself and one's identity in terms of, you know, something horrible that has been done to you, not something you've chosen. So these were some of the questions that were leading me through the story.
One of Louise's darkest secrets is that before she was murdered, she was deeply discontented with her life and depressed. And she knows this at the start of the book, and she starts to understand more about it as the story progresses. I love the way it gave her a chance to re-examine her own situation and her own life from a completely different perspective. She doesn't feel like that anymore, whatever else she's feeling about her second life. I think a lot of us probably wish that we could, you know, just take a step back and look at our darker moments in that way.
Yeah. And I guess that's an example of a way that she has been changed by her experience as the new Louise who's been brought back, that she feels, because she did almost lose her family through being murdered. She feels, you know, in a way, a deep relief and connection to have been given them back.
We need to take a break. More with author Katie Williams in a minute.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
In your imaginings of this world, you know, maybe just a few years into the future, you also conceived of something very different for the justice system. The man who is responsible for the killings of the women in this group, his name is Edward Early, is supposed to undergo something called a benightment, that it's like he's going to be put into a medical coma lasting several decades, in which his brain is going to be stimulated in ways that are supposed to spark empathy. There's a bit of Clockwork Orange going on here in terms of, you know, forcible rehabilitation of people who've done truly terrible things. And then after he's reintroduced into the world after decades, something resembling restorative justice is supposed to happen, where he talks to his revived cloned victims. I mean, all of this serves a certain kind of plot point, but I could feel you exploring some different possibilities for justice, too. What was on your mind when you imagined his fate?
Well, like you said, I wanted to explore different ideas around justice, rehabilitation, reparation. There's a scene in the book, I hope it's not too much of a spoiler, where we do get to meet him and see that he's been given these kind of empathy heightening drugs, and we see his reaction to having empathy chemically induced. I just wanted to sort of see what would happen in a scene where I had a character who, you know, had done these horrendous things and did seem to suffer from a complete lack of empathy, experiencing empathy emotionally. And I was also just on a craft level thinking about how can I do the, like, Hannibal Lecter, Clarice Starling thing in a fresh way.
Right.
But what's been cool or interesting to me is some readers have read that scene as Edward Early, the serial killer, going through a kind of torture as he's being made to feel and to therefore reflect with this new feeling on what he's done.
Can you explain what Luis does for a living, if you don't think it spoils how that unfolds?
No, I don't think it does at all. Yeah, so she does a kind of care work where she holds people. And because we're in the near future, it's all virtual, so like VR. So she and her clients, they meet in a virtual space. And, you know, to hold people, touch therapy, it's a real career. But of course, the virtual VR part of it, I don't think that exists yet. But the Louise and her clients can wear virtual skins. It's the term from the book, which basically means they can appear any way they would like to in the session.
It's also an implied haptic device, so that if someone were to hug you in this virtual space, you could feel it.
Yes, exactly.
I just had one more question for you, Katie. Every Michigan reader, I think, who picks up the book, and especially every Lansing reader, is going to have a few moments in it. Why did you choose to set this in Lansing?
Yeah, I grew up in Okemos, in East Lansing. I went to Okemos High School, and I went to University of Michigan for my undergraduate degree. And so it's an area that's very, very deep within me, who I am, because I was writing a book that is, first of all, set in the near future, and second of all, has some sensational plot elements. It helped me to ground that by using a place that I know so well and have known since childhood.
I mean, the idea that these technologies and the things in these people's lives are happening in a place like Mid-Michigan, I don't know, it made the novel feel a bit more lived in for me than if it had taken place in Los Angeles or New York or someplace else that might be more commonly used for futurist fiction.
Yeah, I'll tell you, April, I had it set in San Francisco initially, and it just wasn't working. And it was for that exact same reason. Like, I didn't feel kind of my feet on the ground in the story. So shifting the setting, which I did fairly early in the writing process, helped me make the story feel real for myself and hopefully for readers.
That's fascinating. Katie Williams is the author of My Murder, a novel that was published in June, and it's on bookshelves near you right now. Katie, thank you so much. The book is a great, great read.
Thanks, April. I appreciate it.
My Murder is the next pick for Michigan Public Reads. We'll be discussing the book in late May in Lansing. Stay tuned on michiganpublic.org for all the information. That's the Stateside Podcast for today. I am April Baer. You can find full Stateside shows at michiganpublic.org. Today's pod was produced by Rachel Ishikawa. Other producers on the show are Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansag, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our intern is Olivia Meradian. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Music for the pod comes from Blue Dot Sessions and from Audio Network. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you next time. Bye.